Hello, welcome to episode 45 of 10-0. I'm Maria.
And I'm Caitlin.
And it's your birthday.
Yay.
We're recording it on your birthday. Oh, hey.
Oh, God. She's making me open a present on my birthday on the podcast because she's an asshole.
This is Jeremy. Yeah,
spoiled it. Well, you know. He is your husband. And he's good at that. Ooh. I almost bought one of these the other day. Ooh, toasted marshmallow.
All the coffee stuffs.
Even though technically I'm not supposed to drink it.
You're fine. You can drink water out of it.
Thank you.
That idiot.
What?
You didn't take the fucking price tag off the bottom before you wrapped it up.
It happens. I am the same way. Like, I'll forget.
Dum-dum. No problem. Oh, shit. Well, do we want to just jump right in?
Sure, why not?
Okay.
You know, before I fall asleep.
Well, yeah. So I'll start with our true crime fact of the day.
Okay.
We are going to... Oh, this is the one I did like 3 dates for.
Oh, God.
Because I couldn't figure out the right damn date.
My damn date. And I'm like, what the fuck are you doing?
Oh, God. Okay. April 8th of 2005 in Atlanta, Georgia, the Olympic Park bomber Eric Rudolph agrees to plead guilty. So in January of 1996, a 40-pound pipe bomb exploded in Centennial Olympic Park, killing 2 people and injuring over 100. He was also charged with a series of bombings across the South at women's clinics that performed abortion. Because, you know, he's a fantastic human. Fantastic.
Yeah. Well, do you want to go first or do you want me to?
I don't care.
Well.
Whatever.
I'll go first.
Okay.
So, we're going to go to Italy.
Mm-hmm.
If I butcher any of the pronunciations,
I can't wait.
I'm not sorry.
I can't wait.
Oh, gosh. So, we're going to Pavilia Island.
Okay.
Pavilia is a small island located between Venice and Lido in the Venetian Lagoon.
Already?
Of northern Italy.
Mm-hmm.
Apparently, like I said in, a couple episodes ago, my tongue is wanting to, go 10 times faster than my mouth does.
Mm-hmm.
But a small divides the island into 2 separate parts. The island first appears in historical record in 421. Now 1421. 421.
Okay.
And was populated until the residents fled warfare in 1397. For more than 100 years, beginning in 1776, the island was used as a quarantine station for those suffering the plague and other diseases, and was later used as a mental hospital.
Mm-hmm.
And because of this, the island is frequently featured on paranormal shows.
I wonder where.
Right. The mental hospital closed in 1968, and the island has been vacant ever since. But now... you're not allowed to even go near the island without permission.
Yeah.
So that's our little...
you have to get federal permission.
Right.
Or their,
Yes.
Country permission, whatever they want to call it.
So that's our little backstory.
Okay.
Okay. So, as I said, visits to the island are prohibited.
Prohibido.
But various books and articles report on visits by writers or photographers. One of the photographers actually described it as a place of peace and serenity. But it's said to be the most haunted island on Earth. Or even the most haunted place in the world.
Okay.
Well,
I mean,
they're probably not wrong.
To be fair, pretty much every haunted place claims that.
Right. But this one, I kind of believe at this point. The little island, it was first mentioned in print in the early 5th century as a safe haven from invasions by Alaric the Goth and Attila the Hun during the decline of the Roman Empire. So numerous and easily defensible were the small islands in the lagoon, and the military forces left them alone. It was basically so easy to defend these small little islands along the canal that they just didn't have any problems. Which, you know, would be nice. Seeing what's going on in the world now.
Yeah.
But Pavilia had probably been populated long before then, as historical records indicate that a group of Proto-Italians first inhabited the Veneto region as early as 2000 BCE. Around 864 CE, the governor was killed, and 200 of his slaves fled to the island and presumably led quiet lives. During a war with Genoa that began in 1379, the officials enforced the residents of Pavilia Island to move to a different island in the Venetian lagoon, and they built an octagonal fort and turned Pavilia into a military outpost that was armed with naval artillery to strictly control the lagoon.
Mm-hmm.
The island remained uninhabited in subsequent centuries. In 1527, the governor offered the island to the monks, who refused the offer, but they did find a purpose for the island when Pavilia Island became a colony and dumping ground for victims of the bubonic plague in 1576 and 1630.
Lovely.
So we're going to go backwards just a little bit. The first major bubonic plague that struck Italy began in 1347 in Sicily and had spread to Venice by 1348. Roughly half of the Venetian population succumbed to death, and this taught the Venetians a great deal about the movement of the disease. They concluded through observation how the disease spread and how people and ships were introducing the plague to the area. Officials realized that they need to separate the sick and the dead, plague victims, from the healthy individuals, so they set burial pits for the corpses at two locations outside the main city.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. However, the number of dead bodies were piling up so rapidly that the two pits soon became overwhelmed. Thus, in order to manage the overflow, the city began to transport masses of dead bodies to the two major islands in the lagoon. San Torresmo and San Martino di Strada. In the early 1400s, the Venetians invented the concept of the lazaretto, and it's an institution or hospital designed for quarantine.
Mm-hmm.
Of the ill and potentially ill people. Lazaretto Chia? The Chia? I don't know. Told you. I'm gonna butcher shit. It's fine.
It's fine. It's all fine.
A small island in the lagoon was the home of the first hospital. During an excavation on the island, archaeologists unearthed more than 1,500 of the bubonic plague victims.
Jesus.
The scientists believe that there were still thousands more buried in the ground. So during the following epidemics of the plague in the 1570s and the 1630s, various islands, including Pavalia, served as quarantines and dumping grounds for masses of corpses.
Ugh.
At times, barges were necessary to ship the bodies. Anyone stricken with mild symptoms was quickly stripped away from their families and societies and taken to the island. It almost kind of reminds me of what they said was going to happen with COVID.
Yeah. Like, if you had the sniffles, they took you and put you with dead people.
Yeah.
Like, didn't give you a chance to get better.
Right. And this, like, with the whole, when COVID first started, and people were refusing to get vaccinated, the vaccine became available. There were talks. There were talks of going into houses. If you were confirmed that you had COVID and you refused to get vaccinated, they would rip you away from your family. I think that's unconstitutional, but like I said, there was talks about it.
I was going to say, I don't know if that's like an actual thing or something that somebody just
made up.
Found on the internet.
Yeah.
Just for shits.
But that's what this reminds me of. Fear-mongering. That's what this reminds me of. Or that's what COVID makes me think of is this. So, of the lagoon, the Pavalia Octagon is one of four that still survive. In 1777, the Magistrate of Health took control of the island and turned it into a checkpoint. Any boat or ship heading into Venice needed to pass a rigorous inspection as a preventative measure against diseases.
Valid.
In the 1790s, two ships failed, and officials found cases of plague on board. As a result, Pavalia Island became once again a quarantine colony for roughly 10 years until the early 1800s when the hospital shut down.
Mm-mm.
Like, this island has seen so much fucking death.
Maybe it is the most haunted place on Earth.
In the early 20th century, the government repurposed the island's buildings as housing for the mentally ill. As time went on, sinister stories about the treatment of and experimentation on the patients filtered to the outside world. Some say the doctor committed suicide as a way to escape accountability for the grisly human experimentation he conducted on the patients. Other stories claim that tormented souls who suffered on the island haunted him, and his only escape was suicide.
There's always got to be the one sick doctor.
Right. Yet another version says someone or some entity pushed him off the tower.
Well, if you were to do experiments on me and probably kill me, I'd probably push you off a tower too.
Right.
I'm just saying.
The patients and staff finally abandoned the island in 1968. It has remained unoccupied to this day, except for allegedly a population of tormented ghosts. The remaining built a hospital, a church, and a shelter for boats are crumbling away with time.
Mm-hmm.
In 2014, the Italian state auctioned a 99-year lease of Pavalia, which would remain state property, to raise revenue, hoping that the buyer would redevelop the hospital into a luxury hotel. No, thank you.
Absolutely not. When we went to, that makes me, so Katrina, right?
Yeah.
Hurricane Katrina. When we were in New Orleans and we did our ghost tour thing,
mm-hmm.
we did, or we drove by the old hospital.
Yeah.
That, I think I told you about this. It's vacant.
Yeah.
They cannot clean it enough to get all the bacteria and shit out of there to make it a functional hospital. They're trying to turn it into fucking apartments. Are you fucking kidding me? You can't clean it well enough.
Absolutely not.
To make it a hospital. Why would you make it into apartments? Like, a hospital obviously needs to be spotless and no bacteria, as little bacteria as possible. But you want people to live there?
Right.
No. Absolutely not. That place has got to be haunted as fuck.
Right.
Blah, 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 blah. No, thank you. Mm-mm.
So, back to...
Sorry, squirrel.
The doctor. Because, you know, I knew there was more to the story and I couldn't remember all of it. So, according to the legends, one doctor, in order to become famous, started performing procedures on patients. He used tools like hand drills, hammers, chisels to perform lobotomies on patients as a cure. Patients who did not cooperate were taken to tower and heartlessly punished. And it said that after a few years, the doctor jumped from the bell tower as he was disturbed by seeing the ghosts of Pavilia. He survived the jump. Here's where it gets creepy. But was later choked to death by a mist that came up out of the ground.
I would be that mist.
Right. So,
if you performed a lobotomy on me, I would be that mist.
Right. So,
absolutely
many
not.
Many people who have visited the island say that they still hear moans and cries and the coughing of plague patients. Some say there are some violent ghosts in the buildings. They've received touches, pushes, hits, and have even reported being choked on the island. Many say that they were scared to death. It said that a family visited the island with building a holiday home for themselves there, but left the first night.
If you're me,
right,
and my insane list making when I go on vacation somewhere, you do research on the place you're going
right.
to go to, and you figure out what happened on this island, then you don't fucking go.
Yeah. So
you pick another one.
Yeah. So there's one incident of a man who fled the island when he heard a voice asking him to leave the place immediately and never come back.
Yeah, bye.
Yeah. So, Ghost Adventures went.
Mm-hmm.
I remember this episode because it's the first episode that they have on air where Zach gets possessed. Zach was possessed for nearly a third of the episode. And you literally watch him go from normal Zach to angry, pissed off, like, ready to rip somebody's face off, Zach.
I think I've only seen that episode once.
And, like, Nick, at the time, because he was still there, and Aaron are, like, trying to talk to him and talk him down.
Right.
And he doesn't even know, like, he doesn't acknowledge them whatsoever because he doesn't know who they are.
No.
And it creeped me out. Like, the first time I watched that episode, I was like, oh, shit.
No, it's you.
I'm like,
bye.
You know. So, other than that, the screams and the moans have made the island unbearable to live. The local fishermen have even stopped fishing near there because they still find human remains in their nets.
Can you imagine fishing and pulling up a leg?
Right.
Oh. Absolutely not.
Right. Okay, so the state auctioned a 99-year lease.
Right.
The highest bid was from an Italian businessman named Luigi Bernaro. And he planned to invest 20 million euros in a restoration plan. The lease did not proceed because his project was judged to not meet all the conditions. Other sources suggested that the deal was canceled because his bid was too low. Like, they wanted more money.
I don't imagine there's a whole lot of people fighting for this lease.
No. Probably not.
So, I feel like that's a you get what you get.
Right.
If somebody gives you a dollar for that lease, you fucking take it.
Right. So Brunaro initially fought the cancellation of the lease, but after he became mayor of Venice, he renounced any intentions to the island. So naturally, a site connected to so many methods of death has lived on in popular imagination to this day. So we talked about Ghost Adventures being there. The show Scariest Places on Earth has featured the island, and it's also been the subject of multiple fiction and graphic novels. The surviving buildings on the island consist of a cavana, which is the boathouse, a church, a hospital, an asylum, a bell tower, and housing and administration or administrative buildings for the staff. The bell tower is the most visible structure on the island, and it dates back to the 12th century. It belonged to the Church of San Vital, and was demolished in 1806. And the tower was repurposed as a lighthouse. That's all I got.
I would for sure be haunting that bell tower and that doctor. That's for damn sure.
Yeah.
Make sure you didn't survive that fall. Absolutely not.
Yes. This says, visitors to Pothalia have been forbidden for decades. Of course, that doesn't stop the occasional thrill seeker from taking a boat over to the island. Some look at it as a dare. Some are genuinely interested in experiencing a bit of paranormal. However, all who venture there return shaken. One thing visitors report experiencing is the sensation of being watched.
Gee, I wonder why.
Others report being scratched and pushed by invisible forces. Some entities have been said to push visitors into walls or chase them down corridors.
I'm out.
It said that the asylum is filled with ghosts of abused patients. What asylum isn't?
Especially an old one.
Right.
I mean, look at Waverly. Look at...
Right.
What is it? Eastern State Penitentiary? Mm-hmm. Look at those.
Yeah. Visitors to the asylum report seeing shadows on the walls moving along with them as they explore the decaying facility. And a handful of psychics who have been brought to the island claim that there is energy that can only be described as malignant, with the presence of angry spirits lingering there, so deeply frightening that psychics and paranormal experts refuse to ever return. Charred human bones still wash up on the shore.
I'm sure they do.
I don't think that because it was haunted, that's why everyone fled.
That had to be one hell of a haunted place for a bunch of people to leave.
Right. So here's what I wanted to find. The daughter of the island's owner had her face ripped apart.
On the island?
On the island. The family that I said went and left after the first night.
Yeah.
Years after Pavalia Island's mental hospital was shut down, a family decided to purchase the island, intending to build a private holiday home. They arrived and got settled for the first day, excited to begin their new adventure, but that first night was filled within hours. The family fled, never to return. They reported that their daughter's face was nearly ripped off by an angry resident entity. But that's all you can find on it. To me, I think that's just a ghost story.
I want to believe it, because, you know, ghosty stuff.
Right. But I feel like that's really outlandish.
Yes. For something to have the energy to be able to almost rip someone's face off.
Right.
Come on.
Yeah. That's all I got.
That's a little much, I think.
Yeah.
Thank you. Okay. This one involves a lot of skin, fair warning.
Well, I mean, it is Ed.
So. Just saying. So we are going to Plainfield, Wisconsin. Edward Theodore Gain was born in La Crosse County, Wisconsin on August 27th, 1906. He was the second of two sons born to George and Augusta. Ed's father was a severe alcoholic. He was unable to keep a steady job. His previous employment included a carpenter, a hide tanner, and an insurance salesman.
Oh.
That's kind of bouncing.
Yeah.
Bouncing all over the place. George also owned a local grocery store for a few years, but sold it. After that, the family moved to Plainfield after purchasing a 155-acre farm. Their mother took advantage of the isolated farm life and sheltered her two sons from any negative influences of the world. Ed left the farm to attend school.
Yeah.
Outside of school, Ed spent most of his time doing chores on the farm. So, Mom was a very religious person.
Yeah.
She always made sure to teach her sons about the immortality. Nope, that's not the right word. Immorality of the world and the evil of drinking and her belief that all women, except herself, were naturally promiscuous and instruments of the devil.
Sure.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, the promiscuous part isn't wrong.
She took time every afternoon to read to them from the Bible, usually selecting verses from the Old Testament and the Book of Revelation concerning death, murder, and divine retribution.
Oh.
If that tells you anything as to where we're going here. Ed was very shy. His classmates and teachers remembered him as having strange mannerisms, such as random laughter, as if he were laughing at his own personal jokes.
Okay.
To make matters worse, Augusta would punish him whenever he tried to make friends.
Of course.
Tell me you're a toxic parent without telling me you're a toxic parent.
Right.
Despite of his lack of social skills, Ed did well in school, particularly in reading. So, died.
Yeah.
April 1st of 1940, Ed's father, George, died of a heart failure condition due to his alcoholism at age 68. Ed and his brother, Henry, began doing odd jobs around town to help keep the farm and cover living expenses and all that good stuff. They were generally considered reliable and honest by residents of the community. Knowing what we know now, this creeps me out. Ed would also frequently babysit for neighbors, which he enjoyed, and it seemed that Ed could connect more with children than adults.
Mm-hmm.
Henry began dating a divorced mother of two and planned to move in with her. He worried about his brother's attachment to their mother and often spoke ill of her around Ed, who would respond with shock. So, May 1944. They were burning away marsh grass on the farm. The fire got out of control, which drew the attention of the local fire department. By the end of the day, Ed reported Henry as missing. There was an immediate search party sent out for him. He was found dead, laying face down. According to the coroner, Henry had been dead for some time. His cause of death appeared to be heart failure, since the body was not burned or otherwise injured.
Oh.
It was later reported that Henry had bruising on his head, and it was dismissed that there might be any kind of foul play. And the county coroner officially listed his cause of death as asphyxiation. Do we believe that? Did he get hit in the head with something? Did he fall on something? A bruise on his head.
No, I meant like internally.
Nothing. According to the coroner, Henry had been dead for some time. Mm-hmm. His cause of death appeared to be heart failure, since the body was not burned or otherwise injured.
So if he had heart failure, how was his cause of death asphyxiation?
if he fell, he was found laying face down, mm-hmm. and they're in the marsh.
Yeah.
So if his face goes in the water, marsh.
Well, yeah, that would be asphyxiation.
Yeah.
You can't really have two causes of death.
I just work here.
He was hit in the head.
What? They were burning farmland. I mean, a random tree?
No.
I feel like that would have been noticed if there was a tree by him. I feel like it also would have stayed on top of him.
Maybe.
Marshland.
Most of the trees that are in marshland are like cypress trees. And
right.
Those bitches are hard to move. So.
Right. Shortly after Henry's death, Augusta had a paralyzing stroke, mm-hmm. and Ed devoted himself to taking care of her. December 29th, 1945, she died of a second stroke at age 67. So he's now completely alone.
Mm-hmm.
No other family, no nothing. Ed kept the farm and continued to do odd jobs for money. He boarded up the rooms that were used by his mother, including upstairs, downstairs parlor, and living room. Leaving them completely untouched. He lived in a small room next to the kitchen and boarded up the entire rest of the house. At that point, just buy a shed. Like, what? What are we doing? Around this time, Ed became interested in magazines and adventure stories that involved cannibals and Nazis.
Oh.
So we see where this is going. So there's one like full on murder that
mm-hmm.
he confessed to. November 16th of 1957, Plainfield hardware store owner Bernice Warden disappeared. A resident reported that the hardware store's truck had been driven from the rear of the building around 9:30 in the morning. The hardware store had a few customers that day. However, Warden's son was a deputy with the sheriff's department.
Yeah.
Frank Warden entered the store around 5 to find the store's cash register open and blood stains on the floor.
Oh.
He told investigators that on the evening before his mother's disappearance, Ed had been in the store and that he was supposed to return the next morning for a gallon of antifreeze. A receipt for a gallon of antifreeze was the last receipt written by Bernice on the morning she disappeared. Hmm. That evening, Ed was arrested at the West Plainfield grocery store and the Washara County Sheriff's Department searched the Gain Farm. This is where we get a go.
Mm-hmm.
A deputy... I know what you're waiting for, too.
like, the sad thing is, like, I followed this whole thing so much so that I know, like, certain shows and certain movies were based off of him.
Mm-hmm,
so
mm-hmm.
I'm just waiting for everything.
Like, oh, that's at the end, don't worry.
I'm like, oh, I already know all of this, you know. And then in my head, all I can think of is, like, the storyline mm-hmm. and all of it. And I'm like...
That's not right. A deputy discovered Bernice's decapitated body in a shed on the property, hung upside down, like you dressed a deer,
mm-hmm.
With a crossbar at her ankles and her wrists were tied with rope.
Yes.
She'd been shot with a .22 and the mutilations were made after her death. So at least he was nice enough to do that, I guess.
Yeah.
So, while searching the house, we mm-hmm. found a lot of fucked up shit.
Yeah.
We found whole human bones and fragments, a waste basket, I already can't talk, made from human skin,
mm-hmm.
human skin covering several chair seats, skulls on his bedpost,
mm-hmm.
bowls made from human skulls, a corset made from a female torso skinned from shoulders to waist.
Mm-hmm.
Leggings made from human leg skin. just, that makes me want to vomit right there. No, thank you. Masks made from the skin of female heads. Mary Hogan was another potential victim. Her face mask was in a paper bag and her skull in a box. Bernice Worden's entire head in a burlap sack. Her heart in a bag in front of Ed's stove. Nine vulva in a shoebox.
Good.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. A young girl's dress and the vulvas of two females judged to be around 15. A nipple belt. Four noses. A pair of lips on a window shade drawstring. That has to be like the thinnest, crispiest drawstring pull ever. You're welcome.
So all I can, like, as you're going through this list, I'm sitting here kind of laughing to myself because all I can think of is Buffalo Bill dancing in the mirror.
Yeah. And I'm not even.
I know. But that's all I can think of.
Whoa. Where was I? At the drawstring lips. Yep. A lampshade made from the skin of a human face. Mm-hmm. Creepiest lampshade ever. And fingernails. A box of female fingernails. Mm-hmm. Like painted fingernails.
Yeah. Ew. Which, if you have ever seen The Silence of the Lambs, the fingernails play a factor in that movie.
I don't think I've ever seen... I've never seen Psycho. We talked about this when I was doing these notes. And I said
she's
I was going
to go home.
She's
never seen Psycho. Have you at least seen Bates Motel?
No. I wasn't allowed to watch a lot when I was younger.
Sorry, Maria's mom, but you're kind of an asshole.
You know what I was allowed to watch? I was allowed to watch Tim Burton movies.
Well, I mean, at least you got that part right.
Not all of them, just cartoon Tim Burton movies.
Damn.
Remember Cow and Chicken?
Yes.
I wasn't allowed to watch Cow and Chicken.
Fuck.
Ed, Edd n Eddy? I wasn't allowed to watch Ed, Edd n Eddy.
Ed, Edd n Eddy was like my favorite.
I know. I'd be lying if I said I didn't watch it.
Like, so in The Silence of the Lambs, he's Buffalo Bill dancing naked in the mirror.
Mm-hmm.
That is like part of that movie,
right?
But as it pans through his house or his downstairs, like, lair,
yeah,
he's a seamstress.
Yeah.
So you see him piecing together, like, the skin.
Oh, he made a suit, didn't he?
Yes.
Hmm.
So, Buffalo Bill, Leatherface, Norman Bates, the movie Psycho, Bates Motel. Those are all based off of Ed. And there's another cannibal serial killer that has influence on the whole Buffalo Bill thing. It's a lot. But Clarice actually finds fingernails. She finds things that actually, like, lead her to him to make the arrest. And it all comes with the help of Hannibal Lecter, but yeah.
I think I've seen parts of it.
Anthony Hopkins is like one of my favorite actors.
I think I've seen parts.
I love him.
Was this any in like an underground thing with like a plexiglass?
Yes.
Okay.
He is in plexiglass. He cannot, like, have outside interaction with people.
Right.
He's got to be in a cell the entire time, no interaction. Because he's a cannibal. And so she goes and visits him mm-hmm. in his little solitary confinement prison. And then she actually finds the missing girl and Buffalo Bill in his basement. And there's a well. And
puts a lotion on the skin.
Yes. That.
Or also gets the hose again.
Anyway, continue. All right, I've went on my little spiel.
Oh, you're going to make me watch all these movies now, aren't you?
Yes.
Okay.
You know, when
you're, I suppose.
When you're on your very lengthy vacation.
Well, then.
Anyways.
All of these, I guess we'll mm-hmm. call them, were photographed at the state crime lab and then disposed of. When questioned, Ed told investigators that between 1947 and 1952, he made as many as 40 night visits to three local cemeteries to exhume recent bodies while he was in a daze-like state. Mm-hmm. On about 30 of those visits, he said he came out of the daze while in the cemetery, left the grave in good order, and returned home empty-handed. I highly doubt that. On other occasions, he dug up the graves of recently buried middle-aged women he thought resembled his mother and took the bodies home, where he tanned their skins to make his paraphernalia. Mm-hmm. I spelled paraphernalia right, by the way.
Yeah, did you remember the R?
Yes, I did.
That is like...
It's the weirdest spot.
It really is. And it throws me off every time I have to type it out.
Ed admitted to stealing from 9 graves from local cemeteries and led the investigators to those locations. Alan Wilimowski, mm-hmm. I think, from the state crime lab participated in opening 3 test graves identified by Ed. The test graves were exhumed because authorities were uncertain as to whether the... whether Ed was capable of single-handedly digging up a grave during a single evening. And the graves were found as Ed described them. Soon after his death, Ed began to create a woman suit mm-hmm. so that he could become his mother to literally crawl into her skin.
Yep.
Huh.
So.
Hello.
Bates Motel. I'll kind of give you, like, a little bit of information on it. Norman Bates imagines his mother being there the whole time. When really, then.
Is that the show or is there a movie?
That's the show.
Okay.
When really, she's dead. And this whole thing has happened.
Well, now I have to go watch it.
Yes. Yes, you do. You're welcome. Because had I known, like, when it first came out, that this is what it was, I would have had a completely different outlook on the show, and I probably wouldn't have hated it so much. And it would have made a lot more sense.
Well, fuck.
So now I'm going to have to go rewatch it.
What is it even on? Is it on Netflix?
Oh.
I don't know. You look that up. I'm going to continue. Ed denied having sex with the bodies he exhumed, stating that they smelled too bad for him to do anything. Mm-hmm. That's what deters you? Not the fact that it's dead, right. Cold, and rotting?
Right. Peacock. Amazon.
I have Amazon. There you go. Ed also admitted to the shooting death of Mary Hogan, who was a tavern owner missing since 1954, whose head was found in his house, but he later denied memory of the details of her death. Mm-hmm. A local 16-year-old whose parents were friends of Ed and who attended ball games and movies with him reported that Ed kept shrunken heads in his house. He described these as relics from the Philippines sent by a cousin who had served on the islands during World War II.
Yeah.
Upon investigation, these were determined to be human facial skins carefully peeled from the corpses and used by Ed as masks. That brings the term face mask to a whole new level. During questioning, the sheriff for Washoe County, Art Schley, reportedly assaulted Ed by bashing his head and face into a brick wall. Can't say I blame him. As a result, Ed's initial confession was ruled inadmissible in court. And unfortunately, that sheriff died of heart failure at age 43 in 1968 before Ed's trial.
Oh, that sucks.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. On to the trial, now that we're there. November 21st, 1957, Gain was arraigned on one count of first-degree murder, where he pled not guilty by reason of insanity. He was diagnosed with schizophrenia and found mentally incompetent, which meant he was unfit to stand trial. He was sent to Central State Hospital for the Criminally Insane, which is now the Dodge Correctional Institution. It's a maximum security facility in... Why does Wisconsin have to have all the weird town names? Wappen?
Mm-hmm.
And was later transferred to Mendota State Hospital in Madison. So, 1968. Doctors determined that Gain was mentally able to confer with counsel and participate in his defense. His actual trial began November 7th of 1968 and lasted 1 week. A psychiatrist testified that Gain had told him that he did not know whether the killing of Bernice Worden was intentional or accidental. Gain had told him that while he examined a gun in Worden's store, the gun went off and killed Worden. Gain testified that after trying to load a bullet into a rifle, it discharged. He said that he had not aimed the rifle at Worden and did not remember anything else that happened that morning. At the defense's request, Gain's trial was held without a jury. On November 14th, he was found guilty, and a second trial dealt with his insanity. After testimony by doctors for the prosecution and defense, the judge ruled Gain not guilty by reason of insanity and ordered him committed to Central State Hospital for the Criminally Insane. Gain spent the rest of his life in a mental hospital. The judge later wrote, due to prohibitive costs, Gain was tried for only one murder. He also admitted to killing Mary Hogan. So that's that.
Mm-hmm.
As far as the farm, the house and the massive acreage that went along with it appraised $4,700.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I guess it is back in the 50s, 60s.
Yeah.
All of his possessions were scheduled to be auctioned on March 30th of 1958 amidst rumors that the house and the land it stood on might become a tourist attraction. Probably would have.
Yeah.
On March 20th of 1958, the house was destroyed by a fire. A deputy marshal reported that a garbage fire had been set 75 feet from the house by a cleaning crew who were given the task of disposing of any garbage. Arson was suspected, but the cause of the fire was never officially determined.
Right.
Gain's 1949 Ford sedan was sold at public auction for $760 to a carnival sideshow operator. Can you imagine buying a car that was probably in pretty good condition for $760?
Right.
Can I do that? Mm. Gain died at the Mendota Hospital for the Mentally Insane due to respiratory failure due to lung cancer on July 26, 1984 at the age of 77. Over the years, the public has chipped pieces of his gravestone off until the stone itself was stolen in 2000. Why would you want to steal somebody's headstone?
Right.
Especially his headstone. Like, you are asking to find a random skull on your bedpost or have your nipple torn off. The gravestone was recovered in June of 2001 near Seattle and was placed in storage at the Washoe County Sheriff's Department. So, all the movies and stuff that we've been talking about. Rob Zombie's House of a Thousand Corpses and Devil's Rejects was also influenced by him.
Mm-hmm.
Norman Bates, Leatherface, Buffalo Bill. If there's any American Horror Story fans out there, Oliver Threadson from Asylum was also based on Game. That's all I've got. That is the creepy story of Ed Gein and the nipple belt.
Yep. And, I was unusually silent during that whole spiel.
Yeah.
Just because I knew it was coming. I'm like, I already know that. I know all the things.
He's fine.
So it's one of those things where I didn't really have to comment very much.
Simultaneity is fun.
Now I'm ready for bed.
All right. I'm ready for a nap. That'd be great.
I don't have to go home and answer to anybody. I can just go home and curl up and crawl out of bed. That's the only thing I like about spring break. I don't have to take the kids to the babysitter. I don't have to worry about getting them up for school. Like, summer's going to be so nice. The babysitter's going to be broke, which sucks, but except for baby doctor appointment days.
That's not a you problem.
No.
Sorry, but that's not a you problem. Well, you can find all of our socials in our bio.
Yes.
They're also in the show notes. Our giveaway.
Yes.
If we get 250 followers on Twitter and...
Nope.
I thought it was Twitter.
Instagram and Facebook.
God damn, I suck. You do it then. That was your idea.
If we get 250 followers on Facebook and Instagram, we will be doing a personalized Tumblr giveaway. It will have our logo on it. It will 90% sure it'll be sublimation. I will outsource for it. I don't even care. Just because I am unable to work with epoxy. Otherwise, I'd make it myself.
Yeah.
So it'll have some other goodies in it. We're not just going to leave you with a Tumblr.
Lame.
But it'll have your name on it. Might be, blood splatter. Might be crime scene tape. Might be something cool.
Who knows?
Maybe a mixture. I don't know.
All the above. All the above.
And if we hit 250 followers on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter, for a total of 750 followers, we will be doing a one-of-a-kind hoodie giveaway. And that will possibly have other goodies with it as well. We're not just going to leave you with a hoodie. Even though these hoodies are super amazing and they're reverse tie-dye. So
they're super cool.
There are only two of them in existence. And I wear mine all the time. So I might just, block out my face and take a picture of it.
We haven't posted any pictures of us. Nobody knows what we look like.
Nope. That's why I said I'll block out my face.
I was just thinking about that.
So, we will post one of the pictures of the hoodies and see. I think the only ones I have on my phone I, took pictures of.
Or when you were making them.
Or when I was making them and it was dark in my living room. So, well... Anyways.
Maybe I'll wear mine tomorrow and we can figure it out.
Yeah. Anyways, stay safe.
And try not to become the next 10-0.